This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
Toast.
Toast.
Right here. Right now. The most important thing in life will always be the
Movie Squad.
Salute me, familia.
Salute indeed. It's another episode of the original content from the podcast archives, the podcast field that is RTRFM Movie Squad, the podcast with me, Tristan Fidler.
And me, Simon Morato. The original content from the podcast archives. Wow, you really know how to sell us, don't you?
It's just the gift of the gab that I have. And that was all pre-scripted, as you can tell. And that's what it's all about. It's about, the fact that I think recently I looked and we've got a good list of reviews on our Apple podcast page. But I think someone may have, there's a one-star review, I think, on there.
Did we get a one-star review?
I don't know. I think the problem is it looks like it's from a positive review, but maybe it was like an accident or someone kind of who'd already given us a positive review was like, well, I didn't agree with it. I don't know. The mystery is there. The mystery is there. But our record stands as being very high, very
good.
Yeah.
Well, that is... I have tasted my own medicine and it is bitter now that I've received a one-star review. But like you, I'm just going to assume it's a mistake.
Yes, it's a mistake. It's an aberration in this this field. But this is a great episode because we're going to be talking about a particular actor and celebrating his technique, his style, his movies. And we've got a very special guest, the other member of the Movie Squad team, Janice Lurek.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Thank you for joining us for this special episode. It's always great to have you on the regular radio show, 7:30 every Friday morning. And when you're willing to wake up that early and come in and talk about movies, we always appreciate that.
Yeah, no, I love to do it as well. And it's great to come in and talk more in more detail about movies and actors and all those sorts of things.
And to have the three of us here, the squadron,
yes.
That's a nice rarity to get to do that.
Yeah, bouncing off each other.
Yeah, the movie squadron. And we are the movie squadron. There you go. That doesn't sound threatening. But we are here to talk about a particular actor. It's Al Pacino. We're going to talk about Al Pacino because it is, I think, the anniversary of his first film credit, which is 1969, if I'm correct. But it's not the film that you think of. It's actually just some other film that he was a star of. But... you know, he is in two of the big films this year. He played a supporting role in Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where he played Schwartz. And then he also is in Martin Scorsese's three-hour epic for Netflix, The Irishman, which...
3.5 hours.
I stand corrected. But which reunites him with, the fact that they had talked about working together for a long time, Pacino and Scorsese. So this is the first time I think that's happened. But it's also pairing him once again with Robert De Niro. They're kind of the two iconic Italian-American actors from the 70s that sort of have really kind of established a certain type of masculinity and approach to acting. They were together in The Great Heat. They were also together in Righteous Kill, an overlooked addition to the Pacino-De Niro canon. And so we're going to talk about our favorite Pacino films, talk a little bit more about his acting and what he brings to the movies, and as Janice was saying, go in a bit more depth into an actor who provides a lot of depth to his roles.
Just for posterity, though, his first film was a movie called Me, Natalie, where he starred opposite Patty Duke, who won a Golden Globe for the performance. Don't know anything else about this film. I think it has a Harry Mancini score. But when I say opposite, that's probably generous because it was a very small role. Pacino really didn't become Pacino until a certain iconic Francis Ford Coppola film.
Well, true. But then there's also the film The Panic in Needle Park, which is a very interesting kind of movie about drug addiction that he was in with... George Segal, I think, that's one I think that caught Coppola's attention. But yeah, it's funny to think of that he's an iconic actor, but there was a lot of discussion and studio kind of tension with the fact that Coppola wanted to cast him because he wasn't really a bankable star at all for The Godfather.
No. I mean, I believe he had quite a, you know, he had a career in theatre before he started moving into movies. And I think that he built up a bit of reputation there. He was known as a method actor, I think. He studied with Lee Strasberg and kind of that New York City kind of style of acting as well. And yeah, I mean, you know, obviously he was chosen to be in The Godfather, and I think that made his career pretty much from there and set it forward and the pace that it would take.
And in the great history of podcasts, I've already made a mistake. So George Segal was not in the Paddock and Needle Park. It was him and Kitty Wynn, who people might know from The Exorcist. I was confusing that with the Rob De Niro film Born to Win, which is also about the addiction of gambling, I think.
So anyway, all the George Segal heads out there who are just penning their angry emails, they've probably flooded our reviews. Yes. They're worse than the Russian bots.
That's why we're going to get another one. Sorry.
I think I always get there's a great joke that I always remember from, I think it's Just Shoot Me with George Segal, where they're watching some clip of a puppet show and George Segal yells out some line like, he's stealing the show like a young Pacino or something like that. So who knows if that's based on some kind of career tension in there. But we're going to go around and share our favorites and get into it in a bit more depth. But one thing, I think, to start off generally, what do you just generally respond to in Pacino as a performer or as a kind of personality?
Oh, well, I mean, I think he's just got such charisma and screen presence. I think you're inevitably drawn to him whenever he's on the screen. And he's had a few kind of performance styles throughout his career. And we all love a bit of shouty Pacino. I know I enjoy a bit of shouty Pacino. But look, he definitely does have emotional depth to his performances. And I really enjoy seeing that and looking past the whites of your eyes, shouty, gesticulating Pacino. Yeah, that's for me.
Yeah, look, the films that I've brought to the table today are definitely in the shouty range. And he's one of those actors where there's that episode of Community where the character Abed takes a class, Nicolas Cage, good or bad. And I think there's that collection of actors who you could just equally make the argument either way. And I think often it's the big actors, right? And I think even Daniel Day-Lewis falls into that category and Al Pacino as well. But I love a bit of big acting. But Janice, you're absolutely right. I think even rewatching some of those bigger performances, and I recently saw The Irishman, which also has an extremely big Pacino performance, there's still work being done there. It's not just gesticulating for the sake of it. And some of the quieter moments from those movies are actually the bits that you see him come to life. But it is funny, when you watch The Godfather, I mean, I don't even recognize that actor who did that particular movie and that particular performance.
Yes.
I feel like it's The Godfather Part 2 where you can see the turn, because his character in the original Godfather is so kind of like, you know, it's the narrative turn is that this meek son of the family, essentially becomes the head of it, but he's got that really, he's really talking really just low like this all the time, like no. And then in Godfather 2, when he starts, like, his family gets threatened and he starts yelling at everyone, that's when the second wave Pacino is yes, in the ascendance there in terms of the shouty approach to acting. Yeah.
Mike, you don't come to Las Vegas and talk to a man like Mo Green like that.
Fredo, you're my older brother, and I love you. But don't ever take sides with anyone against the family again. Ever.
I mean, I picked The Godfather Part 1 as a film to talk about just because with this particular film, when I saw it when I was, you know, I think about 23, 24, which felt very late. I felt like everyone else had seen The Godfather and I hadn't seen it. And yeah, I had that exact moment where I thought, oh my gosh, is that Al Pacino? I can't believe it. Look at him. He's so young. He's so handsome. Oh my gosh, you know. And I was really struck by that. And for me, I really do enjoy the performance because, you know, I think Pacino talks about the character being very internal and having a lot of the drama is actually simmering away under the surface, particularly in The Godfather Part 1, where, yeah, he starts off, he's this young man. He's kind of like, you know, the pride and joy of the family. He's the one that's been picked to, you know, be legitimate and be groomed to be a senator and get the Corleone family, you know, legit, basically. Mm. And of course, it doesn't transpire that way. And I suppose the reason I really enjoy this performance is is A, because there is a lot of work being done under the surface. And while I enjoy Shouty Pacino too, I do enjoy that kind of under the surface thing. And also just his face. Like, I mean, it's a very attractive face, as I felt, and we don't get that later in Pacino's career. But, I mean, he's sort of this, you know, very sort of, you know, he's this young man and he's sort of beautiful, and you can tell why Kay is really drawn to him, even though there are all these red flags around this particular person, and why, you know, his father adores him so much and he's kind of like the favorite in a lot of ways. But you can see that sort of transformation to essentially like the worst person, like an absolute cold-blooded killer. That occurs, and it's the same face, you know, and it starts off this sweet face, this kind of young man, and then turns into this really kind of terrifying, still handsome, still young, but very, very threatening sort of a face. And that is just done simply through, you know, the subtleties of his performance in that. Mm. And I think that that's really powerful and something that I'm really drawn to with that particular film. Yeah.
I think the, like, a great example of that in the movie, and for me it's like one of the top 10 scenes of all time, and maybe it's more complimentary for Francis Ford Coppola, but it is when he goes to the restaurant, he has to orchestrate the hit, he goes to the bathroom to get the gun, and then he comes back to his seat, and he doesn't just start shooting as he was instructed. And he just sits there silently, and you're thinking, okay, what has happened? And you see the vulnerability there, you see the fear, you see the sort of internal wrangling. But then you realize he's waiting for the train to pass, and he's waiting for the distracting noise, and then he just executes without hesitation. And that's all there, just, you know, under the surface, but it becomes apparent. And I think the work he's doing there, again, it's the kind of acting that that some older critics call indigestion, where you don't actually know if they're doing anything or if they're just sitting there. But you just, like you said, Janice, you're just reading so much into his face. And even though it doesn't seem to be changing, it just has all these layers of meaning.
And a bit of, you know, Pacino flair as well, in the way that he kind of like flings the gun off his hand as well as he exits the restaurant. But it is interesting to think about that film and the ways in which, I mean, it is a tragedy in the fate of that character, but it's almost like the last shot is so iconic, but I guess for some seems like almost like it's his ascendance, or, you know, he is taking over, and that there was still more room or more kind of material to mine with Godfather Part Two, and to see his character completely just bottom out and have no like charm or kind of just attractiveness, really. By the end of it, he is just kind of like this cold man alone at the lake house. But yeah, a classic. The Godfather, Godfather Part Two. Thoughts on The Godfather Part 3?
Oh, well, I actually haven't seen The Godfather Part 3. I know. I was told, oh, don't do it. So I never did.
It's not, look, I think calling it bad is only based on relativity to the other two films. It's not very good, yeah. And maybe it's not good. but it's kind of that interesting thing of there's actually a really interesting story. But, you know, the actual narrative of Godfather 3 is quite interesting, how it ties in with, you know, the popes and everything going on there. But it is sort of that peak period of big, shouty Pacino. And maybe we do see that evolution from 1 to 2 to 3. But it is funny how Pacino's most famous lines come from his, like, most maligned film. So, you know, just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in, and Hoo-ah from Scent of a Woman, which was, I think, within 2 years of one another.
Yes.
It is funny that the way we regard him, and the tragic, inevitable Oscar clip when he expires, they may use some of these, like, moments from these least-loved movies.
You can't be doing this. Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
Oh, are you talking about what they're going to play at the Oscars when Pacino passes
away?
Yeah. We already arrived at that point in the podcast.
Sorry, Al. Sorry. You're very still vital. I love his look these days, that kind of big collared vampire with, you know, the
cardigans and the silver jewelry. Yes.
Well, I was going to say, add Godfather Part 2, Part 3 to his list of very interesting hairstyles, which I think really takes shape from the 80s onwards, where he just, yeah, goes for it in terms of kind of just interesting approaches to his hair, including the sort of like the bird's nest thing going on Any Given Sunday, sort of some of the floppier moments in Heat, where he's got a very interesting curl there. But let's turn to you, Simon. What's a film of Pacino's that you'd like to, you know, kind of discuss and say is one of his best works?
Look, one I wanted to bring to the table is his performance in Glengarry Glen Ross. So this was actually the last time he was nominated for an Oscar.
Oh, wow.
Starring as, what's his character's name? Yeah, Richard Roma.
Ricky Roma.
Ricky Roma, yeah, exactly right, in the David Mamet play. And I think the film isn't that well regarded. Obviously, the play is very well regarded. And when people think of the film, they think of the Alec Baldwin monologue, which was new to the film. But this is one of those great performances where Ricky Roma is sort of, he's charming, he's a salesman, he's obviously very pushy, but he's also not central to the big revelations at the end of the film. But he just kind of inserts himself, and that film is just, and the play is such an alpha power struggle. And I think, you know, Janice, I know you've got some interesting things to say about how Pacino is perceived by the bro community. But I think he really embraced that performance and that performance style.
You stupid f***. You, Williamson, I'm talking to you. You just cost me $6,000. $6,000 and one Cadillac. That's right. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it, asshole? You f***. Where did you learn your trade, you stupid f***? You idiot. Whoever told you that you could work with men?
Him and Mamet, they're sort of interesting bedfellows. I saw Pacino on Broadway in Mamet's China Doll.
Oh, wow.
Which is a sort of infamously bad recent Mamet play. I mean, they're all pretty bad these days, but that was an interesting one where Mamet, that particular play is just all about trying to get his plane out of some tax issue. It's nonsense. It's not good. But the way he writes, and his politics aside, it is just so clear why Pacino is drawn to him, because it just lets him chew the scenery. And again, it's one of those performances where it is big Pacino, but he's so charming, he's so threatening, he's so volatile, and you just want to watch him, even though he is sharing the screen with, you know, Jack Lemmon and Ed Harris and all these other great actors, and we won't mention one of them.
Who shall not be named? But it's interesting that most people remember his performance in that, in the scenes where he is just shouting, particularly at one character near the end. But the majority of his scenes in that movie and that play are him kind of
negotiating, yes, and being
with the Jonathan Pryce character.
Yeah.
Basically having a customer on the hook. And it is like very macho, because it seems to be working on this kind of like implied homoeroticism between the two characters, in the way that he kind of cajoles this guy to sign on the line, which is dotted, which is for fraudulent land deals, which is the kind of the main thing that they're selling.
Exactly, but he is seductive, you know. I think as an actor, he does have like a sexuality to him, you know, and again, that's been used for evil in recent years or bad performances, but he does have that kind of allure. And I think it was almost what you're talking about in Godfather. I don't think it was fully there yet, but there is something really, you know, you just get sucked in by this guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think I do think that with The Godfather, I think that set off a particular type of character, or at least a sets of terms of reference for different characters where, yes, as you say, I think seductive is a really good word for it, because he can be very suave and very appealing. But then there's just this, like, evil. Like, he plays characters that are evil and are ruthless, and I think that comes through. And it's a really interesting combination, because I really think it's a type of kind of masculinity and macho-ness that you don't really see that often, and he manages to pull it off. Like, just appealing and being beguiling, and probably why he was cast as the devil in The Devil's Advocate.
A great performance. You know. Yeah, yeah. He's always, it's an interesting technique where he does things where he's always kind of like keeping his lips wet in a certain way. Like he's either chewing gum or kind of, he's just really like, there's something to add to that as well. Yeah.
There's like a mouth thing going on. Yeah, I'm very interested in different gestures that performers like to use in different performances. And Meryl Streep has got a few where she like fiddles with like a necklace, like, in every character, she's fiddling with a necklace. And I think Al Pacino has some of those as well. Like, definitely there's something about the lips and, like, the bearing of his bottom row of teeth. Like, yeah. You know exactly what I'm talking about, don't you? So, yeah, no, I agree with that sort of, like, in the lips and the eyes and all of that.
And I think that, you know, and this wasn't on my shortlist of good films or even good performances, but something like Cruising, and you think about, you know, his performance in that and what he has to do in that movie, which is kind of like Serpico undercover in the sort of in the gay scene of New York. But again, you have to be a seductive actor to take on that role and to do what that undercover cop is doing. Or is he? Is he a cop? Or he's a cop, but is he, you know, more responsible for the killings than we know? But again, there is a breadth to the kind of performances he does, and it's because he's able to use these different tools for different means.
Yeah, Cruising is a very interesting one, very problematic, very controversial film, but one that's kind of got a weird, like, critical reevaluation, I think, in the past decade or so. But definitely in a period of his career when he was kind of like on the downslope and was making films that were not big box office hits, and that film in particular came out and kind of was widely criticized and did not fare well. And it's interesting to see some of his like career arc in the 80s being an area where he was not at his peak. I haven't even seen Revolution, the kind of much discussed flop about the American Revolution, which was one that kind of left him off the screen for a number of years until he came back with Sea of Love, which was like considered a comeback film for him. So very interesting career to chart. The film I wanted to kind of throw out there is definitely on the list of, you know, when people talk about him, these are the films that come out right away. And it's one of the two films he did with Sidney Lumet, Dog Day Afternoon. I watched that again recently. I don't know what it was. Like, I think I'd always liked it and thought it was great. But watching it again, I was just like, wow, I haven't really considered how amazing this film is in terms of what it does, and particularly the kind of the tones that it manages. It goes from being really funny to being really tense to being really, you know, serious and dramatic to being quite moving. And a lot of it has to do with Pacino's performance. I mean, he is taking up the scenery here, but in a way that is like true to the character in terms of a guy who gets into a situation and is very well over his head when he tries to rob a bank and then gets stuck in a kind of ongoing 7-hour into the night hostage situation. But his performance, I think, is a true marvel in that there's the techniques and the ticks that you could tell with Pacino, but there's also just some glorious moments, particularly when you read the great phone conversation between him and his lover, Leon, was pretty much improvised. And it's just an amazing sequence and definitely an example of his quieter approach to acting, and then the kind of just that expression he gives, which was kind of used on the poster a lot at the end of it, is beautiful. So I just love the range he provides in that one performance in Dog Day Afternoon.
Our coverage of the Brooklyn robbery, where two homosexuals are holding hostages for their demands of a helicopter, a jet,
Sonny,
and safe passage out.
Sonny, they said on a TV, two homosexuals in a bank, right on TV. Did you hear what they said?
What difference does it make? They're going to say anything they want. Let them say.
I'm not a homosexual. You tell them to get that right. Now that's going out on the TV.
Well, Sam, what am I supposed to do? You know, I can't control what they say on television. Well, what do you expect me to do? I mean, I'm doing everything I can. I can't do that. I mean, they. Look, Sal, forget about it. It's just a freak show to them anyway. It don't matter. Whatever they say, it don't matter.
Yeah, that is such a great movie. And an interesting example where, again, he plays a queer character at a time where that, you know, could have been box office poison, but that film obviously is so well regarded, and I love so much about that film. And this has nothing to do with Pacino. I love the way the hostages they don't go through Stockholm syndrome necessarily, but they start to get a bit sympathetic. They start to have a good time, but then at the end, when freedom is apparent, they have no more relationship with their captors. And yeah, that film is just so interesting for a million reasons.
Yeah, and I think you have to be such a charismatic and likable performer to do that. And whilst the film itself was very sympathetic to that character and what he's going through, I think that, yeah, you have to go through all these different tonal shifts. Like, you have to be aggressive and threatening. Pacino had to be kind of comical, but also likable and then vulnerable. I think a lot about how tall he is and the fact that he's not particularly tall, I believe. Yeah, and you can kind of see the diminutiveness of him in that film when he's sort of standing out the front of the bank and gesticulating and shouting.
Attica, right?
Yeah, that's right. And everyone's cheering, and the New York gay community are there, you know, cheering for him too. And I think it's such a physical performance, and you can feel the endurance, actually. When I see that film, I just feel so exhausted by the end, because it's the way it's paced, and it's fantastic filmmaking. And I think that you can see the strain in Pacino, and also, yeah, going through those different tonalities and sort of winning the allegiance of the audience, but at the same time, still being kind of threatening enough and mysterious enough, and he's never off the hook for what he does. And I think that it's such a credit to really everyone involved in that film, but absolutely Pacino as well. Yeah.
And well, you know, that's one of the two, and the other one is Serpico. So yeah, I mean, the 70s, there were some films that didn't exactly light the night on fire. Scarecrow with him and Gene Hackman is a very underrated film that did not reach the success of The Godfather. But I mean, that period, Godfather, Godfather Part Two, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon. I mean, and you look at that kind of early period in his IMDb, and it is a lot of straight wins for. But you know, in comparison to later on in the 90s and onwards, there's a lot of maybe a lot of faff there as well. Janice, what was in like another Pacino film or performance that you would want to?
Well, this is jumping forward quite a long way up, and I think it's 2003, HBO's series, I think it's a miniseries, Angels in America, which is an adaptation of Tony Kushner's Pulitzer-winning plays. I think there was two parts, part one and part two. And in this, this is an amazing kind of series that's an adaptation of the stage play, and Pacino plays the fictionalized character of Roy Cohen, who was, a real figure, conservative figure, the personal lawyer to Ronald Reagan, who died of HIV/AIDS in the 1980s. And so Pacino plays this character, you know, deeply aggressive, deeply conservative, very corrupt. However, in the beginning of the series, he's diagnosed with HIV, and this particular series in this play have a series of really interesting kind of monologues. It's a very monologue-y kind of script. And Pacino is given these monologues where he talks about various things like the nature of power, what it means to be kind of classified as a gay man, as a homosexual, and to be classified as a person with, HIV/AIDS, and how that is not congruent with the way Roy Cohen sees himself as a power broker and as a conservative. And so this performance is big Pacino. There is a lot of shouting, there's a lot of whites of the eyes, a lot of teeth, baring of teeth. But I think that the speeches are so well put together. They're so provocative and interesting. And that's due to the writing of Tony Kushner. And I think that it serves Pacino's performance really, really well in his performance style, because this is a big personality. This is a huge personality talking about really big themes. This is a really big themed sort of a narrative. And I just really enjoyed it. It's very theatrical. It's a really theatrical performance, and just tremendously compelling. And again, we have this idea of Pacino being so masculine and such a figure of masculinity and aggression and violence, but that is a queer character as well. And I think it's such an interesting articulation of the ways in which we sort of see queerness in a particular way, perhaps as not congruent with aggression, masculinity, conservatism. But that character indicates that actually, no, these are you know, preconceived ideas and that they don't mesh together well, or that they're actually not what we think they are. I mean, but Simon, you were saying that you were interested in this performance too.
Yeah, I love the Mike Nichols Angels in America. I think it's one of the actually, I mean, that's such a hard set of plays to adapt, but that's a really good one. And I think Roy Cohn, the performance of Roy Cohn, because again, that is such a detestable person and character. What he does there is really interesting. But the reason I wanted to discuss it is because everyone kind of talks about Scent of a Woman as being this sort of pivot point in his career where he suddenly goes big. But as we've discussed, he definitely had flashes of that prior. But I think the Roy Cohn performance is another interesting sort of fulcrum, because what we've seen really of Pacino in the last 10 years, when we see him, he is usually playing a real-life character in an HBO telemovie. So he's played, you know, Joe Paterno in recent years. He played Jack Kevorkian, right? And again, even in The Irishman, which is kind of a telemovie if you think about it, because it's a Netflix film, he plays Jimmy Hoffa. So he's kind of now in the game of portraying these real life figures who are very well embedded in the cultural narrative. Like Roy Cohn was larger than life. Jimmy Hoffa was larger than life. And Al Pacino, it's almost like he's taking on that mantle, saying, well, I like doing big performances and this is my way of doing that. And I think it almost helps him because it gives him permission to be outrageously big and kind of aggressive like Roy Cohn, which is fared well compared to his other more original bigger characters. Tristan, I don't know how you feel about this later period of Pacino's career.
Well, I haven't seen Angels of America in quite some time, but I remember watching it when it was broadcast on ABC, I believe, here in Australia. And it was, you know, just an amazing experience. And his performance in particular is one that, the character itself being such a kind of conundrum and a hypocrite and but also like on his deathbed in the later period of his life and Pacino just fully going for it, but as he was saying, in a way that is kind of outside maybe the more stereotypical kind of masculine sort of Scarface on the dorm room wall kind of idea of him as a figure, as a character. So yeah, I mean, and it is interesting. He has made, I think he seems less prolific than his compatriot Robert De Niro, in that Robert De Niro just seems to be in so much, and his like quality as an actor has really diluted, in that it seems that it's few and far between the ones in which he is invested or is giving a substantial performance. Whereas I think that Pacino picks things a bit more. He's a bit more choosy, but when he picks something, he still goes for it, even if it's something like playing himself in the Adam Sandler film Jack and Jill.
I love that. I regularly watch that clip of him rapping to the Dunkin' Donuts ad in that movie.
He is not sleepwalking in that movie. He is giving it his all. But I think the 90s is an interesting period because obviously he gets the Academy Award for Scent of a Woman, a film I remember growing up with and thinking, oh wow, this is such an amazing film, what a great performance. And then you watch it later and you just think, there's so much about this that's like just not good and problematic, and his performance being such a kind of like just over the top buffet, particularly when there is a kind of a board meeting for Chris O'Donnell's character at the school, which is turned into a trial in front of all the students. Is it such a, why would this happened is so
the climax
like,
of that movie. People may not remember what the Scent of a Woman is even about, and it's such a weird movie. Like, it's like a stupid plot.
Yeah, and a really off-putting title as well. Oh, just can't get past the title.
not so many great sexual monologues from Al Pacino's character in that one.
That's
about,
right.
So Tim, you know, he has, but he gets the Academy Award, which has long been discussed as kind of like an award given for the sum of his career rather than the actual performance itself. And then the 90s is, he's kind of back. And the film that I always love, because I'm a Brian De Palma fan, is Carlito's Way, which is them reuniting after Scarface. Scarface was a controversial film at the time, but became kind of a cult classic. Carlito's Way is a bit more underrated, but it is interesting to look at his performances in both, because he, I guess, in the great tradition of Hollywood, just going, well, this performer is ethnically ambiguous, they can play anything, right? So in Scarface, he's playing a Cuban character. In Carlito's Way, he's playing a Puerto Rican character with accents intact. So things that probably would not fly today in the in today's casting or would get a lot of pushback. But I mean, he's such a big performer, and I guess the character of Tony Montoya in Scarface is so iconic. It's really escaped such kind of I think criticism in a way. Carlito's Way, for me, a lot of it is down to De Palma and his filmmaking, but I think for me it's a great Pacino performance because it's like a movie star performance. He's the kind of romantic lead in this film about a gangster who is released from prison, wants to go straight in the classic mode of the genre, but he gets pulled back in, and I think there's a lot of great stuff about it's all kind of cliche Pacino firing on 11 cylinders. There's a kind of romantic, world-weary narration. There's a lot of big scenes in courtrooms or with his acting partner, Sean Penn, who's really going for it as his shifty lawyer. And I love that film, and I love his kind of, as well his look, the leather jacket and the shades. It's a very kind of stereotypical Pacino kind of emblem of masculinity, but one that I always respond to, particularly in that film.
Yeah, and I must say I've never sat down and really thought deeply about Pacino's career, but even just talking about it now, I see themes emerging in the kinds of roles that he plays. Like, for instance, kind of death and the inevitability of death and death surrounding this character. Also, I guess the fall. You know, we're talking big themes here: the fall of man and the inevitability of sin and the challenge of living a moral life, or perhaps maybe the fact that from the moment that you're born, you're doomed, you're already amongst the damned, you know, and I think that that is something that pops out again and again.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, that's a period where he's still, like, the lead, and I think that when you get into the late 90s, it becomes the technique becomes, let's get Pacino and a younger actor, and they're kind of the combination that we've got here, where he is the kind of elder mentor, you know, devil's advocate, Keanu Reeves, Donnie Brasco with Johnny Depp, The Recruit with Colin Farrell, and Two for the Money, which is long been on my stand queue, but I still have not watched with Matthew McConaughey. But it feels like that kind of 90s period was the last of him kind of being sort of the matinee idol, or hanging on to that before graduating or grandfathering on to being the role model for the younger actor to kind of to shine.
Donnie Brasco is an interesting one, though, because he's kind of low status in that movie.
Yes.
Like, he's only high status in relation to the Johnny Depp character. And then as it's revealed over the course of the movie, he's really not much of a power broker at all.
And if you're talking the themes that Janice was mentioning before about the fall, one of the, you know, best acting scenes is him kind of like about to be taken away to his untimely fate, but kind of like putting, he starts to take off his kind of jewelry and his wedding ring and it's like just a quiet scene of him putting all the stuff into a drawer. He goes to close it, and then he goes, you know what, I'm going to leave it open. And then he walks out. And this is such a, it's not involving any shouting, any kind of dialogue. It's just him quietly kind of doing stuff, but it has so much meaning because of the context of the scene.
Well, I want to bring forward one more film that has a lot of shouting, and that is Heat, the Michael Mann film that did, you know, unite him and Robert De Niro for the first time, and they have that great scene together in the diner, of course. What I love about this film, though, and I haven't always loved this film. I know you're getting ahead of me, and I'm not there just yet, but I didn't always love this film. I used to think it was quite boring, just sort of long, and then I rewatched it recently, in the last sort of 2 years, and what I really loved about it is, you know, I'm probably less invested in the Robert De Niro story, the actual, you know, criminal and his relationship with Amy Brenneman's character. But what it kind of occurred to me is that this is this cat and mouse thriller has a great cat side of the story because he's trying to, you know, solve this case and get to the heart of it, and it's really, the movie is a big dick measuring contest, but Al Pacino has real swagger in this film. And I know, look, man, maybe it's a bit lame, and he's kind of using a lot of street slang, and he's got like this kind of sing-songy, you know, voice, and of course he has the iconic line, because she's got a great ass. But I love even that moment where he's having this sort of tete-a-tete with Robert De Niro, and it's kind of regarded these days as, oh, it's a classic scene, it's a masterwork of, you know, things that go unsaid, and it's very minimalist in how they're kind of interacting, and it's not shouty. But he just has that kind of line where it's like, brother, you are going down. And it's just so fun. And I love that about Al Pacino, that he still is, I think he has an appreciation of why people like him, and maybe it's the wrong kind of fan that he's now trying to feed. But I think he does appreciate that he can be fun in movies, and he is very fun throughout Heat, even though his character goes through some like terrible things.
You know, we're sitting here, you and I are like a couple of regular fellas. You do what you do, I do what I gotta do. And now that we've been face to face, if I'm there and I gotta put you away, I won't like it. But I'll tell you, if it's between you and some poor bastard whose wife you're gonna turn into a widow, brother, you are going down.
I mean, I know, I do like this film, and I think there's a place for theatricality and that. I mean, we all, you know, I do like to have a little giggle about that movie just because you know, the whites of the eyes, the just.
Oh, it's his most cocaine-fueled performance. I mean, you know, not to say he took it, but inspired by it.
Yeah, well, for sure.
There was a recent thing I read that there was possibly, like, that was a storyline that was cut out of the film, that his character was kind of like possibly minorly addicted to drugs, because he just seems to be... Like, even the moments, and they must have given him free rein as well, because, like, even when he sits down with Tone Loc's character and he's, like, talking about the doggy, and you know, you get shot walking your doggy, and the actor's just, like, looking at him going, what? You know, like, and it is one of those films where he seems to be operating on a level unto himself
and
in certain ways.
Chewing gum a lot in the mouth. It's like, Pacino, what are you doing with your mouth? Your mouth's involved again, and it's freaking me out. But it's great. I love it. I don't know how I feel about it. And yeah, the movie starts with like a love scene as well with Pacino in it,
yes,
before he's even uttered a line of dialogue, which is such an unusual way to introduce a male character. Like, I don't think I've seen that very often in films. And I don't know how it plays into it, but I always think about that when I think about this movie.
I mean, it is such a very macho text as well, because it's like he has like the iconic scene of, look, his partner Diane Rivera are trying to like get through to him about his daughter who's suicidal, and he's like talking about like, you know, how hard the job is and how that just like shapes him, and it is I mean, but it is such a fun performance, even if it is kind of so, I mean, in that classic Michael Mann mode of just being kind of like very over the top in terms of asserting this kind of professional working man cops and robbers machismo. But we're coming near to the end of the episode and celebrating this actor. Well, what about a film that you would say is either his worst performance or has the most kind of, if we're talking about his talent as an actor, like any other kind of films that you would either say is the lower point of his career, or is Too Much Pacino?
Too Much Pacino. Well, I did while I frantically scroll through his filmography just to bring those bad ones back to light. I will say that sort of an unsung Pacino film, even though the film is very highly regarded, is The Insider, and he does get to monologue really nicely in that film. You know, well, when I say nicely, I mean he gets to have a big monologue. You know, he gets to chew the scenery. But there's so much of that movie that is understated. You know, again, another Michael Mann movie that does sort of roll it back a little bit. To be honest with you, I haven't seen a lot of his recent bad films.
Hangman.
By the way, I'm just looking up. I didn't even realize this. He did Phil Spector as well.
Yes.
Which what a wig that must have been. I got to look that up.
Apparently, I've not seen it, but apparently a bit controversial because it does like Mamet's kind of tendencies towards, I don't know, just kind of like, you know, protecting the rights of gun nuts is comes through in the dialogue, maybe. I don't know. But I was just thinking it's funny because when I was a young kid, to me, Al Pacino was this character, Big Boy Caprice, in the film Dick Tracy, which I loved, which when you see it is him under a layer of makeup looking totally unlike himself, but completely like chewing the scenery and doing that thing where it sometimes is like he's operating on a language or slang that the other characters are kind of trying to catch up to. So yeah, very much in the kind of the hallowed mode of Pacino being very much Pacino. But yeah, any other favorite films?
I mean, I do want to just give a shout out to Scarface, because we've already talked about the problematic nature of this, but I just love that sort of you know, the I'm going to say sleaze, and I'm not saying that I love sleaze, but I like I love talking about what sleaze is and what does it mean for something to be sleazy, and what is the aesthetic of sleaze. And when I think about that, I think a lot about Brian De Palma films, and I think about the fakery and the shirts and the bad tan and the bad acting. And yeah, I've just been toying with this idea quite a lot, like what does it mean to create an aesthetic of sleaze. And I think about Pacino's performance in that, and I think that that's when he takes that suave seductiveness and actually turns it into something kind of appealingly gross. And that's what you see in Scarface. And I you know, everyone talks about the violence, but I just think a lot about the set and the performance styles and the costumes and the way in which that is very compelling, even though it's deeply problematic.
Well, I'd also like a shout out to another over the top film, Any Given Sunday, the Oliver Stone film about Gridiron, which, I enjoyed that film when I was younger, but you're looking at it now, it is a truly, truly bad movie of just over-the-top performances. But he, is particularly fun as the coach, and gets one of those great... It must be, as an actor, you want certain scenes in your reel, and if you play a coach, you're going to get that kind of big speech before the game. And so he gets one of those moments, and he plays it down to the T. But, you know, this has been fun kind of digging into some of the different... aspects of him as a performer and the different areas of his career. I think, you know, having a double of Scarface and Cruising would be a good amount of Pacino sleaze there for you, yes, for anyone looking for a double. But thank you, to both of you and to myself.
Thank
we don't
you,
need to
Tristan.
Thank anyone. We no special guests. We're all with a squadron.
So there you go. We are going to see ourselves out and, once more, honour the work of Al Pacino.
Salute me, familia.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.